Hello, everybody. Good evening.
Hello.
Hey, guys. I recognize some voices there. I hear Mr. Conforti. I hear Loki.
Will
Good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Who is that? I hear some other people. Who's on?
Hello, everybody. Good evening.
This is Ellen.
Hello.
Good evening. Good evening.
Hi, it's Katrina.
Hey, Katrina. Welcome back. How are you?
Doing great.
Good.
Hi, Michael. It's Faye Boggs.
Hey, Faye. Well, good to hear from you again. It's been a while.
Thank you. It has been a while.
Good to have you
Hi
back.
Hi there. Bonnie Brightson.
Hey, Bonnie. How are you?
Good, thanks.
I hope you made it home safely from your Vermont travels.
Long story, but I'll tell you another time.
Okay. Okay.
And
well, we'll
this
get ready
is Ellen.
Who is
this
that?
This is Ellen Michaels in San Diego.
Good. Welcome. Nice to have you
Thank
on the phone
you.
Tonight.
Thank you.
We're just beginning, and we're going to get the recording going in just a minute. We're going to start. Hold on one second. Well, see, Joan is on from Maryland. Hey, Joan, welcome.
Thank you, Michael. Glad to be here.
Good. And to any and all of you that have lived through this recent Sandy disaster, I send you all our best. My father, who's on tonight, was in Staten Island when this whole thing hit. He was safe, and I just heard that a number of people died on Staten Island alone with this storm. It's devastating.
Oh,
some of you were. It's terrible. I know some of you have lived through Katrina. I was talking to somebody today that lived through that. And look, you realize forces are a lot greater than anything we can create with our own hands, you know, abound in the world today. So I wish you all the best. Oh, we're just about ready. And what I'm going to do in terms of protocol, I'm going to begin. We have a lot of people. We have close to 80 people that's part of this call tonight, which is really wonderful. I want to make a couple of introductory comments, and then what I'm going to do is then I'm going to mute everybody in a few minutes. I'll tell Lynn, I'll give her the sign to mute everybody. And you know how to do that, Lynn? Okay. And we are recording right now? Good? Okay. Well, there are a lot of people that have really helped so much in the evolution of this work, and one person I want to really acknowledge is Bonnie Bright, who's on tonight. Bonnie Bright is the founder and the creator of Depth Psychology Alliance, the online Jungian community that went from no people when she first started this to probably 1,500 people today. And it's probably the most prominent Jungian online group in the world. And it's done wonderful things for bringing people together from many, many, many different countries.
People are fading out from no
one. Well,
can't hear
you know
what,
Bonnie, I want to welcome you and thank you publicly. And if you want to say a word about the Depth Psychology Alliance, I think we all would welcome that.
Thank you, Michael. I so appreciate it. And I just want to invite everyone who's not a member to come join. You can find it. It's a free online community at www.depthpsychologyalliance.com. And it's really just an idea that I had a couple of years ago to be able to make Depth Psychology and Jungian Psychology more approachable and more accessible to everyone. And so we've been trying to keep it free and just make sure that we have a lot of great content for everybody. And Michael, I just really want to say how inspired I've been in the Alliance itself by your work and particularly the interdisciplinary aspect of it and just the way that you're able to bring so many different interesting facets to topics that are important to all of us. And so thank you so much for your own
work. Well, you're welcome.
Work.
You're welcome. And you know, it's a time in history where I think a lot of groups are coming together and create partnerships. So you are a little ahead of your time with this one, so again, thank you. Well, I am going to now mute because I know we have a lot of background noise. Hold on one second. I'm going to mute everything right now. Okay, Lynn, you can do that. Because we're going to end up with a lot of background noise otherwise. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to open up for questions in a little bit. Okay. This is a talk I thought about for a long time. And by the response, like I said, we've got about 80 people on the call, either listening directly, listening to the recording, or listening via web right now. So it says to me that this theme of an archetypal perspective is touching the chord for a lot of people, touching a nerve. And as a way of introduction, I want to say I began my Jungian training in New York in 1979. And God, it seems like so many years ago, and I remember it so fondly. It really was a dream come true. And I'm not trying to make this autobiographical, but I just want to begin kind of at the beginning, so to speak. And while they say in the Talmudic tradition that every beginning is difficult, that beginning was not difficult for me. It's something that had begun literally in a dream when I was even younger. A dream that talked about the Jungian approach, dreams of mentioning Jungian analysts I'd never even heard about, and making my journey to Switzerland when I was really young, 19 years old, going over there, thinking I was going to become an analyst. And obviously they sent me home, you're a little bit too young, buddy, come back when you're older, and take the Jung tour. And I realized there was no such thing as a Jung tour. It was a very individual journey. But the die was cast, the stone was already moving in a certain direction. And I found at that point in life something was already shaping the way I wanted to, not the way I wanted to, the way life seemed to have to be lived in order for me to live out this destiny. And I think for many of us, if not almost all of us, that are influenced by a Jungian approach to life, you realize there's a journey. And that's really how I'm going to begin this talk tonight, the idea of a journey. Everybody has a journey. Everybody has a way of life, a style, a code you live by, certain influences that got you to where you are today. And hopefully we can look at our life, whatever point we were at, my father who's 96, his sister who's 101, you know, pretty wild. My son who's 21, and those of us that are very midlife, probably the majority of us, you know, somewhere between 50 and 80. And say, this has certainly been a journey. And while many of us want to say, well, not so much in this circle, but many people in life say, yeah, I chose my life and I chose the direction I wanted to go in. I knew it was either marketing or it was medicine or psychology or business or whatever. And some people really have paved the way that they wanted to live, and they put their little GPS systems on and they went. Other people, you realize it's a very different kind of journey. That this whole thing that we do, this thing we call life, you know, James Hollis calls it the journey we call life, and I really like that. I like that terminology. He's a wonderful guy, a brilliant man. That life is not so much shaped by intentionality as it is shaped by a destiny factor. And you look at the lives of many people that have really shaped humanity, and they were following something. They were following a diamond. They were following some huge creative urge that seemed to pull them and shape them at times against the currents. And many creative people have lived against the currents. I think almost anybody that's made a real contribution in the world, they've paid prices. We've had Dr. Robert Langs on for 2 weeks giving a series of talks. And it was quite compelling to see that here's a man whose vision of psyche was so different from his colleagues that, you know, he went through a lot of alienation. Anyone has got to know that if you have a unique approach to life, there's going to be alienation, and you got to come to grips with that or not. You know what I mean? Look at Jung. I mean, Jung went through his journey. And let's go back to his life a little bit to look at what were some of the real formative aspects of this whole movement of Jungian psychology and what it is about archetypal perspective that influences not only life but clinical treatment, which is the theme of these four lectures. Remember, Jung began as a Freudian analyst. We forget that. We forget it because we look at Jung, we look at mythology, we look at religion, we look at, you know, archetypes and all these wonderful things Jung did, but we forget the beginnings. Go back even further in Jung's life. Jung's mother was a mystic. She was a mystic, she was a psychic. And Jung always said, you know, I had two mothers, mother number one, mother number two. Mother number two was the mother of the night, the mother that knew about tables turning and knew about psychic events and about visitations. And he said, I really loved that mother. She was so different. To her, I could really express my soul. I really saw the workings of another world. And it was that was one of the greatest shapers of his life. His father, as we all know, was a very different kind of figure. He was a minister, not very creative, not very inspiring or inspired. So Jung lived with these two forces. One, masculine aspect that lived according to the rules of the day, the rules of conservation, a conservative approach to life that did things the way other people did them. Under the guise of religion and spirit, it was a settling into something that was no longer vital. And Jung knew that he couldn't live a life that lacked vitality. And if you look at his life, it was filled from the start with this urge, this sort of lion, this thing that lived inside of him that was seeking to be expressed in all ways. And he went to the best of the best at that point in time. You know, he grew up, he realized, okay, there was somebody that was doing really creative work. It was Sigmund Freud. And what was creative about that for Jung was he was a man that was looking at the unseen forces of life. He was looking at what moved life. And at that point in time, he realized a lot of it was about aggression and about sexuality and about drive theory. But he did things that nobody else did back then. He was talking about those forbidden impulses, those forbidden dreams. And that was Jung's entree into the world of psychology. It was also, after a number of years, something he had to exit. Because when Freud said to him it was all about sex, all about drives, Jung said, you really can't be serious with this, can you? You're really going to try to tell me that this life that we see, that humanity or individual life is shaped by one single instinct? Or an instinct is really looking for satiation, the instinct of aggression, the instinct of love, the instinct of sex, the instinct of whatever? And Jung understood that the instincts themselves were motive forces of divine elements. The instinct of sexuality really had little to do with sex. It had to do with sex on one end of the continuum. It had to do with the spiritual urge towards conjunction, the conjunctios. The issue of drive and power had to do with the archetype of authority. So Jung began to see that all of these instincts were expressions in the physical world of transpersonal elements. And he began to look time and time again at what were these things that were driving humanity. And he said, okay, look, I see what Freud has to offer. He was going to be the heir apparent. And he said, I can't go there. I can't settle in that place. And when he wrote the book Symbols of Transformation, he knew at that point, once that book was published, it was going to spell the break that would never be repaired between he and Freud. And when he wrote the book, it was clear to Freud that, you know, he was no longer a Freudian and he wasn't part of the fold. And Jung went into a very deep, on one hand, a depression, and what was turned out to be the major transformative force of his life. And if you remember, in Memories, Dreams, and Reflections, we hear that Jung was just, I don't want to say reduced to, but Jung went back to an early stage of his life where dreams said, go back and remember what happened in the play box. Remember what happened in the sandbox. And Jung did. He actually went back and spent hours in a sandbox having recollections, having reveries. Now, this was a medical man. This was a man who was already gaining renown in the world, who was to be the heir apparent to the entire psychoanalytic movement in the world, sitting in a sandbox playing with sand, designing things. There was no sand tray therapy back then. There was no expressive arts therapy back then. There was no authentic movement back then. He was doing the unthinkable. He was doing what to the world looked like a regression. And by the way, maybe you don't know this, but the American Psychoanalytic Association used his book, Memories, Dreams, and Reflections, as a story of childhood autism. They said, here's the story of somebody who's really crazy. Look what he did. It wasn't crazy. It wasn't about mental illness. It was about a creative urge and about a story of courage where somebody was able to follow these urges, these voices of the muse that said, you got to do this regardless what people are going to think about you, because there's something else moving life. That's not about your drives. It's not about your ambition. That's not coming from the conscious mind. He followed it. And in the same way he loved to sail on the Lake of Zurich, and he would spend hours and hours just sailing, holding to the mast and, you know, letting the wind govern and learning how to control the sail so that he would learn a sense of direction, that became a lifelong metaphor for him, where he knew that the winds were spirit blowing into the psyche, blowing into the human and individual and collective psyche, but one needed to learn how to work with these sails, how to work with the wind so you weren't just driven by it. And he knew archetypal forces, these transpersonal forces that he didn't have words for in the beginning, became the forces that drove humanity, for good and for ill. And I want to read a little piece, which is a description for lectures I'm giving in Washington this weekend, Washington, D.C. And it reads the following. Every ship is tossed and turned by the actions of the sea. One has to quickly realize one's vulnerability and susceptibility to nature's ways. While we train as seafaring captains and use the latest navigational technologies, we are in the end at the mercy of the sea. In the face of such utter power, there is little room for hubris. So too in life, we often find the winds of psyche blowing through us as easily as hail blowing through the shattered remains of a broken window. No buffer, no restraint. We are vulnerable to the whims of the archetypes. At times, we experience the grace and benevolence of psyche, offering us the experience of transcendence, of a profound love and a deep sense of satisfaction with our life and work. And too, we find the storms of terror, of aggressions, of addictions, of betrayals or acts of unimaginable abuse pummeling our homes when we stand at such moments helpless to make it all stop. We often hurt the ones we love. We betray our children and spouse and all others who have come to trust us. At such times, we live estranged from psyche and self. Yet, as demons scream out, angels sing. And we hope and pray for redemption, redemption from those forces that have taken over our life, redemption offering us to create a life and allowing us to create a life in relationship to self and soul. And while ours is an individual journey, there is still the journey, that innate universal need to make a life from what we are given. And as I wrote that, I was just thinking so much about my experiences with more than 30 years as a clinician, and as an individual that has wrestled with a lot of this, as we all have. And I offer that as a preamble to what we're going to be talking about tonight, and those of you that choose to stay on for the next three sessions. What we're looking at is an archetypal perspective on clinical treatment. What is it that, in looking at archetypes in the universal, can help us in working with patients? Let's go back a little bit again and look at what is it that psychotherapy does. Psychotherapy has pretty much evolved to a practice where two people, let's say one-on-one therapy, sit together and they discuss a life and they look at what's wrong with one's life. Even when you have a somewhat humanistic approach, transpersonal approach, we still tend to look at individual factors shaping behavior and shaping destiny. Even when we look at dreams, we're going to have at least one, if not two, sessions devoted to dreams in this series. We look at dreams and we say they're archetypal, the transpersonal dreams, the spiritual dreams, the dreams from the self, expressing archetypes, expressing destiny. And we all too often begin to look at the individual features that created the dream, the individual shapings of images. Jung's work was essentially a transpersonal approach to life. Jung's treatment, which really evolved out of his own journey, and those of you, I know a number of you are part of the Red Book seminar, Paul who's on tonight, and Joan, and many others, Loki. We saw that Jung struggled throughout his life. He journeyed in his life in working with these forces that he didn't know what they were. And when he accepted that he had to make this journey into the unconscious, which is recorded in really quite incredible detail in the Red Book, we saw that he was confronted with unseen forces, unknown forces. And if you look at the prevailing paradigms during his day, the forces in the Freudian model would be reduced. It's your mother and your father and your sister and your brother. It's your drives. It's your hunger. It's your need to satiate the drives, and on. He said, this is not working like that. And it's when he had the dream when he went many, many layers under the ground. and he went from prehistoric to primeval and beyond. And he realized the psyche, this life we have, the unconscious, is not simply a personal unconscious. It's an unconscious that has been shaped by humanity's experiences from the beginning of time. To have a Jungian approach to treatment and to maintain an archetypal perspective is to maintain a historical approach to life. Historical not in terms of individual history, but the history of the species. The history of what has shaped us from the beginning of time. Now, what's lovely about having this occasion to spend time talking about the clinical experience, I think of back over my work, and I still love clinical work. And many people say, Michael, you're involved in a number of things. You're lecturing, you're teaching, you're working with film and consulting. You know, why don't you give up your clinical practice? I don't think I will ever give that up. Maybe my patients will hope I do someday, you know, because you know, I got really wacky, getting too old or whatever in my ways. But there's something that is absolutely precious about going into a room, closing the door, and it's just you and that person there. And you know, even with the two people there, there's a cacophony of how many voices. The voices of the ages, the voices of your own past, the voices of humanity's past, working and shaping your life. And what we have in the individual's life when we hear their story, we hear their journey, of course we hear the shapings of their personal story from their mothers and fathers and, you know, how trauma shaped their life, how gifts shaped their life, and how their own religious and cultural background shaped their life. But you know that all those features really come together as many threads into a much larger tapestry. And a lot of what Jung taught us and archetypal approach to life has taught us is that the tapestries are essentially transpersonal. And in many ways, the personal factors of our life are there to teach us a much bigger lesson. And it was Hillman. I mean, Hillman, who passed away, I think it was this past year or maybe 6 months ago, who gave us so many wonderful gifts. And of the many books he wrote, The Soul's Code was a very special one because it really translated for so many people, for many of the non-psychologically minded people. He talked about there being a shaping element of life, the acorn theory, right? He and Sheldrake and others have talked about this from Goethe on to modern science. They talk about the acorn. And what he said was, and he talked about the lives of so many great people, so many great lecturers and artists and aviators, and he said it's interesting in the early part of their life how many of the great lecturers had speech impediments. How many of the great aviators had terrible fears of heights and adventure? They couldn't leave their home. They couldn't stand to climb stairs, get into an elevator, an escalator. Look at the from a rooftop of a building, look down. And he said it seemed as though there was some complex that was shaping their life, some creative diamond from the beginning, that while it was expressed as fear, there was a lot of energy in the issue of height, in the issue of the spoken word, in the issue of, you know, whatever the particular gift was. And what Jung and the early Jungians taught us was to look at, okay, look, we have all these personal factors that shape a life. But in many ways, the personal factors are contributing to our understanding of the archetypal journey of a life. And it was Edward Christopher Whitmont who wrote in a wonderful article called Anima as Fate. And I have that in field form of fate. I don't have the exact quote in front of me. But he said, where psychology tends to look at trauma as the cause, as the root cause of our issues in life and as the shapers of our life, could it be that the traumas are a way to reveal the destiny of that individual has in their life? And I'll never forget, it's such an important thing he's saying. He's saying, let's not look at the trauma as the biggest issue and the problem. Could it be that the trauma of that individual's life is the soul's and psyche's way of telling you what your journey is about? Now, I remember working with a man who was orphaned at, you know, maybe 18 months of age. And this man had such a proclivity towards psychic experiences. everything from playing the lottery. He was in, I had a practice in Manhattan for a number of years, and he would talk about playing the lottery, winning $100, winning $500, winning $600, having dreams where the dreams would come true, stories he, or intimation he had about somebody, they would come true. And after a while, I was kind of kidding around. I was thinking I shouldn't bother asking this guy for dreams anymore. I should ask him for numbers, for lottery numbers, you know. But he had this uncanny ability of accessing psyche. Now here, you know, many of us that are clinicians, we look at being an orphan, and what do we think about? Well, there's attachment theory, of course, that you can't attach. There's abandonment issues. Well, that's all true. We look at all, think about it. I taught psychopathology for many years in PhD programs and MA programs and psychoanalytic institutes. I know that stuff pretty well. And I'm sure we're all trained in this stuff to look at, wow, man, look at the problems that are attendant with that birth situation. This person, now we understand why they can't attach. Now we understand why they're not really related to the real world, because fears of death, fear of abandonment, and on and on and on and on and on. When we begin to take an archetype approach, your lens is suddenly made so much larger. That's the gift of an archetypal approach. Your lens is larger, and you ask different kind of questions. It's not the causal questions of, why do you do this? What's the root of this issue? The bigger issue is, what field are you brought into as a result of this experience? What world is the orphan brought into as a result of having been orphaned? Of somebody that grows up in a home with other kind of birth situations or early life situations. I remember a young man telling me a story when he was 5 years old, crossing the street with his father, a street where it was just traffic going left and right and faster, and street lights were broken. And he stood on the corner with the father, and what the boy did is he took out a whistle out of his pocket, and he suddenly became a little Moses. Said, "Let's go, Dad. Let's cross the street." Blew his whistle, put his two arms out like a traffic cop, stopped the traffic on both sides. 5 years old. "Let's go. Let's walk across the street." 5 years old, right? This is somebody that became a world leader in their profession. Was that the acorn telling itself? Was that the acorn expressing its story? So when we look at this orphan and you begin to say, okay, look, you know, I have my analytic ideas. I am aware of the issues of attachment, the problems of attachment. I'm aware of the terrible trauma, the loss of not having been loved as a child and being given away. The bigger question is, and we see the bigger question coming from many different fields. Astrology asks some bigger questions. What's the constellation? And I remember when I first began lecturing about field theory, archetypal fields, inevitably an astrologer would come up and say, you know, we're doing very similar kind of work. We're looking at the fields. We're looking at the celestial influences in the life of this person. So here we have an orphan, and we begin to realize, well, isn't it interesting, isn't it striking that a life of somebody that we're accustomed to looking at all the problems and all the disabilities and all the hurts and pains, and we forget that there's something else, perhaps a teleological dimension to life, that there's something else shaping this life. And then you begin to see, if you have your eyes and ears wide open, these interesting, perhaps funny little stories of, oh, I won the lottery again, and I won $400, I won this, and then the dreams of the people I had, I dreamt of somebody I haven't seen for 5 years, and then they call me up the next day, and on and on and on with these experiences. An archetypal perspective pushes your hand and pushes your psyche into a very different domain of work with people. And to frame the question, let's draw from Einstein, who said that many of our answers are not necessarily wrong about life. He said, but our questions aren't big enough. An archetypal perspective allows us to ask bigger questions. How could it be that someone that came from such trauma is able to have this access to the archetypal? These are the kind of questions Jung allowed us to ask and allows us to ask today. And I realized with this case that what it was this man was not brought into, and any orphan is not brought into the world of matter in the way everybody else is. Everybody else that comes into the world with good enough parenting in the beginning, where you know your mom and dad want you, and you know there's enough love and enough home and enough caring and enough stuff, you know, to come in and you feel secure enough. This man came into a world where they were abandoned, where they were not wanted. So where we can find comfort in the tactile, comfort in mother's breast, or comfort in the father's loving gaze as they see their son or daughter, and the mother that can't wait to hold their child for the first time, this kid would never have that experience. Many of the mothers of people that were orphans don't want to see the child because they don't want to have an attachment, because the pain of separation would be too great. So how could it be that somebody that comes from these beginnings could have this kind of experience with the deep unconscious? Now, I'm not trying to say the deep unconscious is coming through because he knows how to win lotteries and all that. The point is there is a propensity to profound experiences in the unconscious, where there, in most of us, is much more of a barrier between the conscious mind and the deep unconscious. In this guy, there was no barrier. There was no, what it's saying, computer language. There was no firewall. He was inundated by these messages from the unconscious, where the veil between conscious reality and those shapers of life, the shapers from the deep unconscious, were constantly present. How could it be? Well, right, we're therapists. We're going to talk about trauma. We're going to talk about trauma. Well, you could say, well, I don't do that. I'm more humanistic. I'm more Jungian oriented. Well, I hope you are. You know, I hope that's why you're on this call, that we want to continue advancing our understanding of Jung and understanding these archetypal patterns of life and learning how to observe them. Anyway, what I realized with this case was a question. I came to a question. I said, what could it be about that early experience of orphan, of where he was estranged from the maternal tie and the love of a mother and father, that created this profound connection to the unconscious? That it was his relationship to art and the unconscious, to music, that was the greatest attachment that he had. It wasn't to the world of matter. You see what I'm getting at? His attachments was not to the world of matter. His attachments were to the world of the transcendent and transpersonal. Let's go back to Eric Neumann, one of the most creative Jungians of all time. He and von Franz and Esther Harding were the greats. Barbara Hanna, they were the greats of this stuff. Because they were the pioneers. They went into the proverbial mines with a little mining cap on with a little light, and they were looking at what these shapers were. And what Neumann tells us is that in the beginning of life, we're adrift in the sense of oceanic bliss. In the beginning, there is no mother, there's no father, there just is a state of existence. And slowly but surely, we come into a world where there are some confines where you know if you're cold, there's a blanket, if you're hungry, there's some milk, if you're lonely, there's a hug. Even in the room when you're by yourself, you know it's secure and there's a mommy and daddy somewhere to care for you. You know you put your foot down and there's going to be solid ground underneath to hold you. This kid never had it. An orphan doesn't come into the world with that experience or that kind of safety. So what do? It's a classic image in the Sistine Chapel of, who is it, Moses? Who is it? Putting the hand in, right through one world into another world. That's your archetypal image of an orphan. Because in the absence of a maternal hold, in the absence of being able to feel secure in this world, they go to the world where they were born into, the world that was even before the mother, into the world of the collective unconscious. That's their world. That's their world of the mothers. It's not the personal. The personal world is, you know, they're adrift in the personal world because it's fraught with terror. So what they do is they stay in the world that is the original world for them. Now, it's so interesting because D.W. Winnicott, another, some of you know these names, a psychoanalyst, a child analyst, he said, in moments of terror, we invent other worlds, alternate realities. what he misses in that is that when someone like an orphan or whomever it is begins to have access to this other world, they didn't invent the other world. That other world is primary. The world of archetypes and the transcendent is the primary universe for all of us, and the journey is from that world into the world of matter. And when there are disruptions or interruptions in that trajectory from the world of the transcendent into matter, which we all need to get our bearings, the interruption does not allow for that trajectory to take place. So we remain adrift, unoriented, at times frightened, and at times really rejoicing in your reality becomes the reality of the deep unconscious. The motive forces of psyche and self are the motive forces that shape your life. It's not the forces of this world, of making a living, of having a home, of having relationships. For them, this is the foreign world. This is the world that they don't understand about. So if we come with them and say, well, come on, you're getting into the world here. You got to get related, man. You got to go to school, get a job, get a career. Now, these are all things obviously are necessary. But if you don't understand their roots, you're never going to get it. And I remember experiences I had with one of my analysts, and he would just look at my life and the way I went about doing my business and my interactions, and he said, Michael, you're just so paranoid how you do things. He looked at me, a white Anglo-Saxon, wealthy, WASP, lovely man, but he said, oh, you know, you're just so street in your approach to life, so paranoid. And I said at that moment, you'll never understand me. If you don't understand my cultural heritage and the world I come from, if you don't take the time to understand the roots of my life, especially being Southern Italian with a strong Sicilian influence, who's Sicily, who has been invaded by almost every country around it and is bred into the Sicilian psyche, into the Southern Italian psyche, that sense and the suspicion of other people. Psyche places us in fields. Psyche provides a destiny factor for all of us. And that's why, as I said in the very beginning tonight, the archetype and the sense of journey, everyone has a journey that we take, and everyone has a journey that you find different things on. But what is universal? What's universal is that there is a journey for everybody, that there are issues of career and love and passion and destiny that have got to be faced in this journey. As an analyst, as a clinician working with archetypes, what you are aware of in having an archetypal approach is that if you are to embark on this journey, and especially if you are to take it seriously and to do it consciously, there are certain nodal points that you will have to pass through, because these are the markers that humanity has taken since the beginning of time, the markers of transitions, the transition from being young to being older, the transition from being from high school to college years, where there's lack of definition to more definition, the definition to begin to establish a career at some point, and maybe we try a couple of different careers, and maybe in midlife you shift, and I have so much respect for people that have shifted careers. And I know a number of people have, and I said, my God, you know, you have had the courage to leave one world, one domain into another, and learn that other world. Whether it's from nursing to law, or law to nursing, marketing to psychology, and on and on. I mean, it's wonderful. And you begin to realize then that in the archetype of the journey, like every mythic story, every hero and heroine story, there are certain points, certain universal points that we realize every hero has had to face. Any Indiana Jones movie, any movie, any story is going to have certain familiar. And the word I like, the term I like, is universal motifs. They will at some point find the other, the journey where the man will find the woman and a woman will find the man or find the other. Where love, whether it's homosexual, heterosexual, it doesn't matter. It's the sense of relationship, a profound relationship to the other, which is an essential marker of the journey. So if you see somebody in a journey, they don't have it, you say, God, you know what? There's some universal step, some universal threshold that the person is not taking. You know, so even if it's a religious life, they have found the love of something, which is profound, from God, the whatever it might be. If there's somebody that hasn't found a way to pay their dues in humanity, and I'm sure we've all seen cases in our careers where the person wants to, what can we say, almost cheat the world of bringing their gifts into it, remain dependent on others for their survival. And we could say many different things about their life. The big issue, now this is another place that an archetypal perspective, in my opinion, is profound. The archetype of morality. Can you look in the mirror when you look at your life and you look at where your life has gone and what you've done with it? Can you look in the mirror and say, I'm doing my work? Because as Jung showed us throughout his collected works and throughout his life, there is an inborn universal moral factor in life. And when there are transgressions, the psyche will yell, the sirens will go off. Not as the Old Testament Yahweh saying you're bad, whatever, but alerting us to what the life is meant to be. There is a life. There is a journey of a life. Transgressions will not be accepted by self. I've had the opportunity, I guess that's the best word, to work with a number of people that have been involved in really criminal activity. I've worked with people whose parents, fathers in particular, and some mothers were involved in very intense criminal activity. And you saw the destiny this kid had. How do you live after these moral transgressions? And you know, Jung was really one of the first to introduce the whole theme of transgressions and morality into the vernacular of psychotherapy. Well, and you know, look, how many of us want to just blow through that? Well, we don't deal with responsibility. Oh, you think about, well, that's my opinion. Is that just, that's just that person's opinion of that person's opinion of what's moral, what's right, and what's wrong. The central arbiter of truth is not personal jurisdiction. It's not personal values. It's what's in the unconscious. You read your biblical stories, you read the Old Testament and New Testament, there are so many stories about an innate sense of justice. And what happens to transgression? Some of you heard the lectures I gave on the story of Jephthah in the Bible, where there are these moral transgressions. From Agamemnon, who slaughters his daughter Iphigenia, to Jephthah, who slaughters the unnamed daughter. These people's lives are forever marked. And what I'm getting at by these stories is to get at what I think is the most important part of an archetypal perspective. And then I'll open up for questions in a few minutes. Where the majority of psychological approaches to life and psychotherapeutic treatments are oriented to the unfolding of personal dynamics and an explanation of life based on antecedent events. And if you think about it, much of what we do as therapists, or we're trained to do, is look at current life as a capturing of antecedent events, what came before. We are what we are because of what came before. And as a way to get into what I'm trying to say here, some of you know one person whose work I really admire so greutly is the work of Elie Wiesel, the Nobel Prize winner, concentration camp survivor, and author of how many, probably 60 books and how many hundreds of articles and plays and cantatas and on and on. And in his autobiography, there's two volume set in the autobiography, he writes that he had a mentor for many, many years. And the mentor, his name was Saul Lieberman, who was considered by many as the greatest Talmudic scholar of our time. And at one point, when Wiesel was in his mid-40s, he would go to his mentor every day. They would pray together, talk together, work on the sacred text together and all that. His mentor said, today, you know what? It's time for you to have a wife. It's time for you to enter that realm of life where you have a wife. Now, he didn't mean as a slave. He didn't mean as just go find somebody to make your life better. He meant enter the archetypal field of marriage. He saw the loss in this man's life. He saw the riches and the gifts and the terror and the fear and the pain. But he also saw something that nobody else was able to see, that he was now ready for this next part of life. And Wiesel had the gift of having found a mentor with whom he revered his actions and his words. And I say to all of you right now, if you have not had a mentor that you really, really respect, I don't mean a mentor like in college. You go to Office 101, you go to Office 106, you go to 304, and you go to your mentor there to talk about your curriculum and all that. No. This is in the spiritual tradition of having a mentor. And I always had the good fortune of working with Dr. Yoram Kaufman for almost 30 years, who was just a brilliant mentor. But what Saul Lieberman said to Wiesel was, it was now time in your journey to enter the sacred field of marriage. And what I take from that story and what I'm hoping to convey as I begin to close this talk tonight is an archetypal approach allows you to see the temporal but to sense the eternal in those moments. That from the temporal experiences of our life, from the day-to-day activities, from the troubles, from the challenges, from the beauties and the gifts, you're able to see the unfolding of not just an individual life, but the unfolding of the life of a soul. The great mentors of our time, the great spiritual leaders, the great analysts of our time can say to you now, the equivalent of now you are to be married. This goes against all tradition in psychotherapy. We all learn, oh, you don't have any values about your patient. You don't ever tell them what to do. You don't ever make strong recommendations. No. The patient has all the answers himself. This is absolute nonsense. I'm sorry, I'll put my cards on there. This is absolute nonsense. It's akin to saying somebody, you need surgery. Operate on yourself. Give me a break. You hope to God, if it was your child that, God forbid, needed a serious surgery, you would hope to God you could find that really skilled professional that knew how to do that work. Those of you that seek spiritual teachers, I hope to God you find somebody whose work demands to be really respected because they've proven themselves as somebody that has wisdom above and beyond conventional wisdom. When you begin to accept an archetypal approach to treatment, you're going against the grain of the conventional teachings of psychotherapy. Okay, you want to cut to the chase? We're going there right now, guys. If you believe the patient has all the answers, now, of course, in the patient's soul there are the answers. And it was John Beebe, the Jungian analyst from San Francisco, a wonderful man, who said, in many ways, the act of interpretation is building a bridge between the internal truth of the patient and their ego. It's letting them know something about the soul. Is that just beautiful? Saul Lieberman knew what Wiesel's soul was calling for. Again, this is going against the grain. Who are you? That's hubris, man. That's hubris to say to somebody you think they need to do this, or to say to them that's not your job. That's not what you're meant to do in life. Who are you to say that to somebody? Jung psychology, as the work of the old sages and teachers, transcended personal experience. And again, I said it a minute ago, I'll repeat it now in context. What they saw in the temporal was an expression of the eternal. They weren't tied down. They weren't limited by, tell me about your mother and father and sister and brother, you're making a living. But they understood that those issues were part and parcel of a much larger archetypal journey. The issue with mother and father are issues with the archetypal concern and the archetypal relationship one has with the mother archetype and the father archetype. Are you making a living? It's not simply the issue of making a living in a career. It's the issue of finding your place in the world, which has been part of humanity's journey from the beginning of time. Every tribe has taught people that you have to find your place in that tribe. You're the hunter, you're the fisherman, you're the seamstress, you're the this, you're the healer, you're the wise one. Now, of course, it didn't just, pin the tail on the profession kind of thing. they found what your gift was. This one was really good at being a hunter. They were able to really see the subtle changes in the grass when something walked by. This one was a great fisherman. This one was a healer. This one was a medicine woman. Incredible medicine woman. She knew how to take care of all these things. They went after the big existential issue in life. And in many ways, an archetypal perspective is looking at an existential approach to life, because it's looking at what your life is meant to be. Now, here's the next part. Where the skill comes in, this gets us to the next week's presentation. If you can say to somebody, that's not what your life is really about. This is not your task. For you, it's not medicine. For you, it maybe is medicine. For you, you know, I know you want to be a therapist. I don't think that's your calling. I have enough evidence from your dreams. That's not your calling, or this is your calling. Why don't you move into the professional psychotherapy and Jung or whatever? What are you doing in the business world? That's not yours. Or you do prosper in the business world. It means learning to read the symbols and expressions of self and soul. In order to learn the skills of learning something about the language of self and soul, you need to do just that, learn the language. Learn the dialects, learn the idioms, learn the ways and the culture of what self and soul have to offer. It will not ever be done through a personalistic experience. What I mean by that is you're not going to approach the transcendent and the transpersonal through the singular lens of consciousness. It is not going to work. One is not ever going to understand the fantasies of your patients, be it sexual or whatever they may be, through the lens of a behavioral psychology. You're never going to understand those more secret desires of your patient through the lens of pathology. It's not going to work. And I remembered, I want to thank one colleague who's on the phone listening to the recording, Dr. J. You know, one of our colleagues, we call her Dr. J, a lovely woman from India who's a gifted clinician in Albany. She sponsored a series of lectures I gave in Albany a number of years ago, and we called it From Pathology to Expression. And it was exactly this point. What we have been in the habit of viewing as pathology is really the expression of self. That takes skill. But as long as you begin to understand that there are things that soul and psyche are expressing through the symptoms, through the disabilities, through the gifts, through the proclivities of the individual, and you can begin reading it, what you're reading is not so much the psychodynamics of the individual, but the unfolding of a life. Now, here's the last point I want to make for tonight. I've been involved in this work for about 30 years now. And I've shifted my work so dramatically over the past 15 years. And again, while I used to be really good at looking at pathology and all of that kind of stuff, I could see what's wrong. I could be the princess in the pea. I could do all that stuff pretty well. I realized to take an archetypal perspective to treatment, you're really taking a spiritual approach to life. And you're helping to uncover and articulate the spiritual issues of one's life and the journey that they're on. In doing that, in many ways, and this is not just an analogy, but it's a parallel. In many ways, the archetypal clinician works like a homeopath, in that you are offering remedies. Not remedies as in making it better, but you know, this individual needs a little bit of gold. This needs a little bit of protein. This one needs a little bit of potassium. This needs, and you know, I have the utmost respect for you, especially the really good homeopaths, because they realize in order for this individual to grow, this is what they need. And I remember as one little example of this, not in terms of homeopathy, but Dr. Kaufman said, Michael, look, with your background, you grew up and your love was a family and tradition and culture. You have to have it in your life. Dinner parties, people around the table, and cooking, and wine, and good cheer, and all that. If you don't have that, you're not living the life you're meant to have, aside from your career and all that. But he said, you have to have that. In the same way a homeopath would say, you have to have potassium in your system to thrive. So what I'm opening here is I'm hopefully trying to open up the roof a little bit so you can see more of the night sky when you look up. You don't just see the confines of what the individual tells you, what they think about life. And having the courage to say to somebody, I don't think that's it, or you know what, this is something you need. I'll leave you with one funny story. I remember I was going through my own, you know, my own developmental stuff. I was probably 28 years old, training in New York. I began, like, say, when I was 26. And at one point, I grew a mustache. I grew a mustache, and I go into Dr. Kaufman's office for supervision, and he said, "Who the hell are you today? What are you, like the pizza boy?" He said, "Go in the office and shave that thing off, will you, please? This is not who you are." And, you know, we had a good laugh about it. He said, "But I'm not kidding. Shave that off, please. If you want to go on pretending, go keep the mustache on. That's not who you are." Now, that story could be offensive to many people. To me, it was the greatest gift because somehow he was able to see into the heart of what was driving my life and the fears that were keeping me from growing into what I was meant to be. Again, it goes against all the books, all the thou shalt nots in psychotherapy, all our rules of neutrality. Who are you to tell anybody anything? Who was Saul Lieberman to tell Elie Wiesel that he needed to marry, that he needed to have the courage to enter the marriage, the archetype of marriage? Those gifted clinicians that may say to somebody, "You know what, this is midlife you're entering. All those signs and patterns and emotions you're going through, those are the signs and patterns of emotions of midlife." I've had a number of experiences in my career where from dreams, I said to somebody, "I think it's time to make peace with your mother or your father because I think they're dying." Not only psychologically dying to them, I said there was something about it. I mean, I remember in particular a couple of dreams where they saw their mother on a pier and beginning to take a long journey in a boat, in a large cruise boat. And they said, "Look, who knows for sure?" I said, "But you made your talks with your mom. Have your reconciling talks with your mother because I think she's going to pass." And lo and behold, within a matter of a month, a mother that was never even sick passed. It's happened at least 2 to 3 times in my career. Because, look, when you enter the world of archetypes, you leave the world of space and time. When you enter the world of archetypes, you leave the confines of the outer world as we know it now, where we have space and time and past and present and up and down. How do the fairy tales begin? Una volta tante anni fa. Once upon a time, many, many years ago. It's the timeless time. Once upon a time, many, many years ago, the archetypal world is not bound by space and time. It's not about just your mother and father. It's about the archetypes that encompass the world of mothers and fathers. Destiny is something that transcends space and time. The verb in Italian, destinare, is not to go to one place, but it's about an orientation into life. It's an orientation. Maybe for you it's orientation. Destinare into the world of teaching, into the world of therapy, into the world of taking care of children and what have you. And the last piece I tell you really could have been at the beginning, but one of the early things that shaped my work to get into this, and some of you know this story, I was working at a place called Willowbrook State School in New York, which was closed down a number of years ago. It was a school for really terribly developmentally disabled kids. And you may remember Geraldo Rivera. That's where he really made his mark. He did a whole expose on it. Anyway, I was working there, and conditions you didn't even want to think about. It was so bad. But anyway, every day there was a recreation time, and this was during the nice warm months. And it was on really beautiful country grounds. And they had maybe 100 acres in Staten Island, New York. And they let the kids out every day, say around 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and this one little boy every day would do the same thing. He would sit against the wall when he was indoors, sit against the wall, drooling and, you know, whatever else he was doing. But he was basically, you couldn't find him emotionally. He was gone. They opened the doors, and he would run to the flower garden. And what he would do, he'd run there, he'd pick flowers, he would make a crown of flowers. He put it on his head. I swear to you, he became a different child with that on his head. He was transformed into something else. And it was at that moment, not that I knew it cognitively, but I knew something changed in him as a result of his relationship to this symbol. And here, 30 years later, I see that Jung's work is all about the symbolic approach to life, how symbols and a relationship to symbols can change our life. They offer us an intimation of a life waiting to be lived. They offer us the intimation of a destiny that's ours. They offer us things that we need to incorporate into our journey every day. But I knew that this kid was changed. Even if it was for 10 minutes, 5 minutes, even 2 minutes, he was taken out of hell. The hell of that was his life. He was taken out of it. And suddenly he was transported to another world. I don't know where he went to. I don't know what that world was, but I knew it was a much better world. And it was the symbol, that the field of growth and beauty and flowers that somehow gave this kid, gave him something, gave him heart, gave him love, gave him something. And that's where I'm going to end this talk, and I'm going to open up questions in a minute, to say that it's a symbolic and an awareness that there are these transpersonal movers and shapers of life. And it's attendant upon us, if we begin to take an archetypal perspective in life, to say, yes, there are these fields that you can touch. There are the, whatever the flower garden is for you in your life. For you, it may be opera. For you, it may be dance. For you, it may be lovemaking. For you, it may be cooking dinner. For you, it may be being around friends. My father cooks for half the neighborhood where he lives. For him, that's being with God himself. And to be able to pro-offer these in the way a homeopath pro-offers remedies. So look, I'm very excited about the seminar series, and I'm really so happy that we have such a wonderful response to this. I'm going to open it up for questions for a couple of minutes, and if we have static, we'll do the best we can to eliminate static. So let's open it up right now. Lynn's going to open up the phone lines for us. Okay, we're on. Any questions or feedback? Are people having other conversation in the background, because we hear those. Are there any questions that, or anything?
No.
I think, I don't know if we're hearing other people having a private conversation or what it is in the background.
Yeah, I figured. You guys told me.
Hey, let's take a minute. Let's just maintain silence for a minute so we can limit any background conversations, okay? Maybe some people are listening by computer and are here. In
wow, background. Your conversation was coming true here.
Yes, it was. That's what it is. We're trying to eliminate that. Okay, so now that we eliminated the background conversation, are there any comments or questions that come up for you as a result of the talk tonight?
Sorry. It wasn't your fault.
I'm having trouble hearing anything. We can't hear. Well, guys, we really can't hear any questions. So what we're going to do then is, I guess, we'll try one more minute here in case we could hear anything. You know what we could do? There's a thing, I think it's star, what is it, to raise hands. What's that? Pound or star?
Star 7?
Star 2.
Star 2.
Star. If you press star 2, it means you're raising your hand, and then you have a question. Let's maybe try it that way, and then we could just mute everybody else except the person raising their hand. It's star 2 on your phone. Okay, here's one person. This is, okay. Okay, from British Columbia. Who is that?
Hi, it's Faye.
Hi, Faye. Okay.
Hi, Michael. I don't have a question, but I wanted to say, just make a comment and say that I was very moved by your presentation, and it really struck a chord with me in that that is the way that I know that I should be working. And so
thank
I'm
you.
Looking forward to lots of information and lots of learning in the next sessions.
Thank you for saying that very much. Thank you. I mean, look, I find I'm still working this every day, trying to learn as much as I can and be as sensitive as I can to these expressions of psyche through dream images, through fantasies, whatever. It's an incredible journey. And I realize the more we do this, it's as though you have a certain ongoing relationship with the transcendent that's talking to you and learning to learn a little more each day about how it communicates. Thank you for that, Faye.
Mm.
I think there's another question here. Hold on. This is from San Diego.
Hi, this is Ellen.
Hi, Ellen.
I wonder if you could say something more about the markers or the information you get that allows you to know when you are giving correct guidance.
Well, number one, you always need some kind of secondary validation to know if we're on target. I think you're asking a twofold question. Number one, what are the markers that give us information as to what we need to comment on? And number two, how do we validate whether we're on target or not? Number one is, excuse me, what you begin to find with when you're reading patterns is that there's a coalescing of patterns in one story. That people, somebody begins to tell you about a life, tell you about a journey. And there are certain things that we realize that this is an intense experience for somebody. This is more powerful than they ever realized, because you know this is something that will dramatically affect their life that already has in the past and the future. So you begin to have a sensitivity to some of those universal markers. I mean, that's, I think, the first response, okay? There are universal markers. Second thing is, in terms of knowing if we're on target or not, often what the client will talk about afterwards or the next dream will give you an indication whether you are right or not, accurate or not. I'll never forget, I made an intervention to somebody once, and they said, oh, I had a very interesting dream the next session, right? They come back after I made what I thought was a good intervention. They said, well, they dreamt of a baby that had diarrhea, and the parents were putting a Band-Aid. They handled the diarrhea. I said, man, I really blew that intervention. That really was pretty far from accurate. But what you found, the interesting thing is, the psyche is really interactive and adaptational. It's going to interact to what we do and what we say. But I think the major thing is, I think the best thing I can say to your question, which is an important one, is being aware of universal markers. And if you have a sense of the thresholds of life, like as I mentioned, the thresholds from childhood to adolescence and on, and you begin to realize the constituent activities that go with that. When somebody begins to try to live a life and avoid some of those steps, you know, you got to put your emphasis right there. What about that? How come there's never, ever, ever been any emphasis on career? How come there's never been any emphasis on the maternal, on the paternal in your life? How come there's never been any emphasis on engagement in the collective? And then the other thing that's so striking is when you begin to see some symbolic expressions of the destiny factor, and you begin to see it. Next week I'll tell you some stories about that, of some specific stories of how you begin to learn how to do this. I think the long story short, it's a sensitivity to universal processes. And I'll give you a word for this. It's ethology. Ethology is a study of natural patterns. And in many ways, you know, I begin to look at the work we're doing as archetypal ethology, to have a sense of what are these universal proclivities that are part of, you know, parcel of everyone's life. Maybe one or two more questions. Any more, Lynn? Okay. Well, on that point, we are going to stop for tonight, and I hope if you find this of interest, you join us next week. We're going to begin looking at how the configuration, this is also part of your question too, how the actual configurations in psychotherapy, the interactive dynamics, how we structure therapy, how they ask us to structure therapy, how therapy begins to be configured, is really an expression of the archetypal constellation in the individual's life. So, next week again, that's what we're going to be doing. And if you're interested to kind of get acquainted with that whole theme, I recommend you read the Threshold book I did, because it's all about initial interviews. So we're going to focus on the initial interviews, because really, it's going into creation mythologies. And the creation myth of the individual journey between patient and therapist, you begin to find in the original conditions of therapy as they're established, are really the self's way of structuring that dyad to give you a picture of the archetypal story of the patient's life and often the therapist's life. So with that, if you're interested in joining us, give Lynn a call or email to the office. She's great. She's been here all weekend probably 17 hours a day. We had a big weekend conference, and here we are almost after 9 o'clock tonight. So I want to thank Lynn for all the work she's done to make this a great program. And I hope you join us next week. And if you're interested, we have a number of training programs in archetypal dream analysis and also a two-year training program where we train people to be pattern analysts. And any question about it, give a call. I'll be happy to talk to you. So anyway, thank you, everybody. Bonnie, thanks you so, so much for all your ongoing support with this. And we'll see some of you next week. And if not then, we'll see you some other time. So thank you so much. Good night, everybody.
Thank you. Good night.
Thank you, Michael.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much.
Good night.
Good night. You're welcome.
Thanks, Michael.
Bye-bye.
Have a great
Bye.
Night.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night, Dad.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
The moderator has left the conference.